You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Association of Firefighters Local 42, and the International Association of Machinists Local 778. Greater Kansas City Firefighters Local 42 is an affiliate of the International Association of Firefighters. We are your firefighters, EMS professionals, communication specialists, prevention and logistical support members within the Greater Kansas City metro region. We support labor and labor education that is provided by this program. And the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working class people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight and logistics, and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working class families. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Missourians are going to the polls on August 7th to vote on two initiatives that are important to working people. Question 1 for Kansas City about rental property inspections, and question A for Missourians, also known as Right to Work. We'll replay an interview with Bill Fletcher, who says, "Right to work has nothing to do with freedom of choice. It's actually appealing to greed." In the news, wage theft and other crimes are taking a toll on Delco Construction, and Department of Labor rescinds another Obama-era rule. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, July 26, 2018. According to the Economic Policy Institute, Proposition A would force all Missouri workers to accept lower wages and force women to accept a particularly high pay cut. Male workers are forced to accept 14% lower wages, or $7,326 per year on average, when a state passes a law like Proposition A. Meanwhile, female workers are forced to accept 16% less per year, translating to a $7,849 pay cut on average. The attack on workers carries over to other fields, too, with so-called right-to-work states having 5% lower rates of health insurance, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and 2% higher poverty rates, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Because they feel targeted, women in St. Louis and Kansas City gathered at special meetings of the Coalition of Labor Union Women today to recognize the women who in 1978 stood together and helped soundly defeat right to work on the ballot. This year, women are playing an outstanding role in the campaign to defeat Proposition A. Jessica Padola leads the campaign in Western Missouri. Sharon Pettiford was released from her union, CWA, to work full-time on the campaign, and there are so many others. Today, in the Women's Day of Action, women who defeated so-called right-to-work legislation in 1978 shared stories with young activists, and then all went out to canvas.
At this morning's labor media meeting, an organizer of the Delco construction workers gave an update on the campaign for justice for Delco workers being conducted by Missouri Jobs with Justice in partnership with non-union iron workers. Delco Construction, a company based in Springfield, Missouri, has committed wage theft, forced employees to work in unsafe conditions, and threatened workers for organizing. The campaign to pressure Delco to abide by the law and treat workers fairly has had a number of public actions and visits to customers. So far, Jeff Delmont, the owner of Delco, has not reformed beyond giving his workers a raise and improving lodging for them on jobs. However, his lawbreaking is costing him a lot. The report today outlined that his company has lost 23 jobs because of the campaign, had to pay an OSHA fine of $1,200, recently settled 6 unfair labor practices cases, but there's still 4 more pending, and faces wage theft cases by 13 former workers that should cost in the area of 6 digits. The organizer said the campaign is winning, but it still needs support. The next action will be in Springfield on August 14th and 16th at 10 a.m.
The Trump Labor Department is scrapping another Obama-era rule, PAI reports. The rule forced union busters to disclose whom they work for and how much they spend on anti-union campaigns. Instead, the department is reverting to letting such persuaders disclose their customers and their spending only when they try directly to persuade, read, strong-arm workers into voting against unions. The Obama administration issued the new rule requiring more disclosure, but it sued by the Chamber of Commerce, which found a right-wing federal judge in Texas who stopped the rule from going into effect. Unions, of course, have to disclose every penny they spend on anything, but employers can easily hide the money they spend to bust the unions. This is just another example of how much more heavily regulated unions are than employers and how the playing field keeps being increasingly tilted in favor of employers. Before yanking the rule, the Trump administration had to invite comments. It got an earful. People wanted more disclosure from the union busters so workers would know who was trying to twist their arms and how much bosses were paying to get them to vote no union. There were over thousands of labor protests, including 6,813 letters from workers gathered by the AFL-CIO alone, and 1,399 more gathered by the Teamsters. It didn't matter as the Trump administration was dead set on rescinding the rule. On July 20th, Trump's DOL yanked the Obama persuader rule change for good.
Finally, the HuffPost reports ICE officials are arresting more undocumented immigrants at their workplaces and conducting more investigations of businesses to see if they employ undocumented immigrants, according to numbers disclosed by the agency on Tuesday. From October 2017 until July 20th, ICE made 984 workplace arrests, more than 5 times the number of arrests during the last fiscal year, from October 2016 to September 2017. During that period, ICE arrested 172 people under what the agency calls worksite enforcement. The agency is also targeting more businesses suspected of employing undocumented immigrants, opening 6,093 investigations so far this fiscal year, compared to 1,716 conducted last fiscal year. According to the new statistics, ICE has also initiated nearly 4 times as many I-9 audits, in which agency officials mandate employers to prove that their employees have documentation to work in the U.S. The increase is consistent with the Trump administration's larger crackdown on undocumented immigrants and zero-tolerance enforcement of immigration laws. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Jen Zaman, Jacob White, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Hello, everybody. This is Jacob White. You're listening live to Heartland Labor Forum here on 39th and Main Street. And I have 2 special guests in the studio with me today. Henry Lyons and Michael Duffy. Thank you guys both for joining me today.
Hey, Jake.
How you doing, Jake?
I'm pretty good. So we've got an election coming up on August, I think it's the 7th, and there is going to be ballot initiative raised question one, and it's for a residential rental inspection program. So we have 2 folks here who know quite a bit about this topic.
on either side, and so I want to first let them introduce themselves and explain which side of the ballot initiative they stand on, and then we'll talk a little bit about some more of the details of what this looks like and why it's happening and what it could mean. So, Henry, can we start with you?
I'll pass to my cohort here that that they went out and worked and got the petition together. They should be the ones to speak for it.
Okay.
Yeah, Jake, I'm Michael Duffy, and I do public interest law. I've assisted tenants in landlord-tenant issues for many years and helped advise on the drafting of this particular ordinance. So, yes, I'm very much in favor of this. I think this is something the city needs. In my experience, tenants face a lot of difficulties dealing with their landlords, and having a routine city inspection program will definitely assist the quality of the housing in the city. Let me just take, if I can, a minute to describe what is this petition doing, what's going to happen. Right now, the city has city code inspectors that look at housing conditions, the quality of housing. However, they're only authorized to come inside an apartment upon the invitation of either the owner or the tenant. Otherwise, they're not really permitted to set foot on the property. So it's entirely a complaint-based system, and cities that use this, including Kansas City, find that by and large, tenants are very reluctant to do this. They're often afraid of retaliation, of eviction, if they make any complaints. Surveys around the country have documented that less than half of the tenants with serious problems make use of this complaint system for a number of reasons. So what's new and different about this particular initiative petition ordinance is that it would, for the first time, give the city the authority to do random inspections, to go into apartments on a random basis and make sure that they're safe and they're healthy. The city health department would enforce this. They've put together a one-page checklist of things that they like to look for, whether it's mold or chipping lead paint or other health hazards, open wiring, that kind of thing, that would endanger the health or safety of the tenant. They have to give the tenant notice. They have to give a 5-day notice to the tenant so they don't make surprise visits to disturb people. And in fact, the tenant under this ordinance would be authorized to say no, and only a court order would permit the inspector in. So we think we've protected the rights of tenants, and we're also allowing a system of making sure that the apartments get inspected and these things get caught before they really hurt somebody. That's the goal here, to preserve the health of the tenants and preserve the integrity of the apartments before they get too deteriorated or people get too sick. The analogy I like to use is with restaurants. Right now, the city inspects restaurants both when there's a complaint that somebody got food poisoning, but they also do random inspections of restaurants to make sure that the places are safe and healthy, so we don't have to wait for somebody to get poisoned before we find a problem and get it fixed. Same thing should be true of apartments. When somebody has an apartment, there should be a solution before it gets to the point of harming somebody. How extensive is this problem? Well, the city recently did a survey just within the past couple of months of Kansas City residents and found that over 25% of the residents say that there is some significant maintenance issue that has not been dealt with by the landlord for a substantial period of time. So everybody knows there's a few slumlords out there that run terrible apartments, but this is more than just one or two bad apples. That's a very high percentage of tenants that have significant unresolved maintenance problems. This inspection program is designed to try to identify these issues, which are health and safety problems, notify the landlord, get them fixed up, and have some teeth in it to make sure that these things get fixed. So that's the overview.
Okay. Well, that was about like 3.5 or 4 minutes. I want to try to keep it pretty balanced. So, Henry, we'll give you like 3.5 or 4 minutes to respond. And
I appreciate it because I disagree with everything Mike just said. Okay. Statistics can say anything. And in that he said that there's a checklist that this health department is supposed to go by. I have a copy of the petition and the ordinance right here, and nowhere in these 15 pages is there a checklist that he said exists. So you're voting on something that you don't know what is supposed to be inspected, and landlords don't know. So I don't know where this checklist is, but the public surely doesn't notice. He also said that the inspector can't go on the property. That's not true. An inspector can go on the property anytime he wants to. He can't go in a unit, but he also cannot go in a person who owns their own home's property either. That's an American right. You should not have the right to just go into somebody's apartment or somebody's house that they own. You shouldn't be able to do that. So there again, these statistics about people don't know who to call, that's not true. Tenants know to dial 513-1313. Everybody knows how to do that. This statistic about 200,000 people said something's wrong with their house. I don't know of any survey that's been done like that. I don't know who did the survey. I don't know what questions were asked. But you know the most important thing about this whole issue, and the really thing what it boils down to is, if this was so important and people really felt it was necessary, why haven't the African-American community, which they say, which he didn't mention, is the one most affected about this ordinance, why don't those leaders in those groups support this? And they don't. Freedom Incorporated, just to give you some historical background, Kansas City was racist a long time ago, as we all know most cities were, under political control of ward bosses. Freedom Incorporated was established, and they stopped that. And they've been in existence since then. They got public accommodations passed and everything. Freedom Incorporated's board passed last week to vote, test citizens to vote no on this right here. The Kansas City Call newspaper, it's the second largest black African-American newspaper west of the Mississippi, is voting and puts, it has to all come out this tomorrow to vote no. The editorial is no on this issue because it will adversely affect the black community. It will adversely affect blacks and poor whites and Hispanics finding a decent place to live. That's what this ordinance is about. It's a way to stop development in the minority community with the guise of helping people. If they really wanted to help people and thought renters were so in such bad shape, or you think they're going to go and inspect too light, they're not too light, just passed. It passed all the city codes. It did everything. So if that's the case, they're going to come to the minority community and inspect that. And minorities, Hispanic, black, and whites too, nobody wants somebody coming in their house uninvited, inspecting whether they're there or not. They set a 5-day notice. That means if you say yes and you're at work, you still can come in their place and inspect their unit. You don't have to be there. And if you're a decent person, you probably will be working. So the government's coming to your place. They're going to walk around your place. They're going to inspect your closet, open up your stove, inspect your refrigerator. This is not some communist state that you can just go into people's homes. And then they say that you can refuse. They also got in this thing that's on the ballot that if you refuse, they can go get a warrant and come in your apartment and inspect it. They come in your rental place and inspect it. So if they're so concerned about people living in decent housing, why do they threaten you with the fact, if you don't let me come in, I'll go get a warrant and I'll come in anyway? This is just, and I'm going to let him speak some more because I'm going to show you how it's a money grab. The city's in financial straits, and I'm going to show you how it's a money grab after he goes through and finishes what he wants to say.
Okay, well, Michael, you can definitely respond to that, but I would want to ask, are there other... you know, are there other large cities that are enforcing ordinances like this, and are they sort of like East German style police states now because of this ordinance? And
no, hardly. There's many, many cities around the country that have, and locally, that have taken this measure of having systematic licensing for landlords and inspections, random inspections. Nearby, Kansas City, Kansas, has had this in place for 10 years, and I've not heard these kind of complaints there. Independence just recently adopted this. Dallas, Houston, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Boston. I mean, there's cities all over the country that have enacted these kinds of measures, some recently, some for many years longstanding. And they're finding that it makes a big difference. I want to point out in particular a small city in North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. Enacted a comprehensive landlord licensing and inspection program, and they found that the incidence of residential fires declined by 50% after they enacted this program. Several years go by, the state legislature becomes very conservatively oriented. They preempt the local Asheville ordinance. It gets repealed. It goes back to a complaint-based system like we now have in Kansas City. And the incidence of residential fires shot up the following year by over 120%. That's a very clear example of how this works in other cities to protect the safety of tenants. Now, Henry raised a concern about the integrity of the home and the concern about the tenants. No inspector wants to barge in when the tenant is not there. That's not going to happen. There's going to be a notice to the tenant, an arrangement when the tenant's going to be there to make sure that the tenant, first of all, consents to the entry, and the ordinance specifically provides that they can decline. And yes, a warrant can be issued, has to be issued by a judge. This is not a city decision to barge in on somebody who says, no, I don't want to have my apartment inspected. So this is, again, and I should add, there's additional language in the ordinance that says that the inspector can only look at health and safety issues. They can't look at how well you keep your house or if you've got, you know, illegal firearms or dope. Or I mean, that's specifically off the table. They're not even permitted to report any of that information if they happen to happen upon it. So, no, I don't think any city that has enacted this has had a problem. In fact, the tenants are typically very grateful that they have this opportunity to have their apartments inspected and issues found and ordered fixed without them having to confront their own landlord about this.
Again, he's off a little bit here. There's been no growth in Kansas City, Kansas, I hate to say. No growth in Independence, which we all know. And if we talk about statistics, the investment in the rental property in these areas is not there anymore. People are not going there to buy things and put, invest them and make them better. They're not doing that because they know that the city is stopping for new investment and new improvement. Number two, he mentioned about these Dallas. There's orcs in the paper. I can furnish the listeners if they want to know. Later on, we can find a way to get that to them. Dallas is unhappy. Minneapolis is unhappy. Houston is unhappy. No growth. Nobody coming in to invest in real estate or affordable housing. Rents have gone up, and the rents here are going to go up too. And if you notice, people in the audience, if you're listening here, I want to make sure that you understood. Mike never addressed the fact that people who've done something in the urban core to make it better for people don't like this. He didn't address that issue because he can't, because they don't. And they know it will stop growth. They know it will be a hindrance to people finding decent places to live. So if this is such a great idea, I ask the question again. Why aren't these people supporting it? And number two, the most important factor, everything they want to do. I brought this sheet of paper. I know it's ready. You can't see. But we did a, we compared this 20-page thing that's supposed to be voted on that is so vague you can't really tell what's going to happen. Like I said, those six little items he's talking about is not mentioned in here. Everything they want to look for can already be inspected. Everything they're talking about should be looked at. In fact, it's more that can be inspected now than what this petition asks to be inspected. And in fact, you can go into people's houses when they call in with no problem at all. And if he thinks the city's going to come by and inspect somebody's house at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, I want to see where they're going to pay people to do that. Because if you're a working person, you usually work from 8 to 5. He's saying you can be there for the inspector. That means the city's going to have to pay people at night to come in and inspect your apartment. And I don't think a lot of people want to come home from work, have dinner, sit down and want to relax, and then want a city inspector coming through at night. And I don't think the city's going to pay people to come by at night and inspect your price. So where else are they going to come? In the daytime when you're not home. But the most important thing is everything this ordinance says needs to be done is already done. The city inspector is already there to do it. There's no need for this ordinance to be in exist. In fact, be honest about it, the inspection list now is greater than what they talking about. And these statistics about we got bad property or bad property there, then why are people living in Kansas City if it's so bad? If things are so rough, why are people coming into Kansas City? Why was Two Light built? Why are there new constructions going on south of the river? Why is the apartment business doing so well now if Kansas City is such a bad place to live? But with this ordinance passed and rents going up to cover the cost, because he didn't get into the monetary thing here, they want to charge every landlord $20 a unit to register to have his units registered, which they already registered now. There's an ordinance right on the books now. If you want to find out who owned the property, every landlord and his agent has to register with the city now, and it's free. And every landlord does it. They want you to do it again. So now you registered twice, and they want to charge you for this one. And if they go through and find something wrong that we don't know what it's supposed to be, in order to come back and inspect your unit again, they want you to pay $125 for reinspection. If they come and find something wrong again, you got to pay another $100. So if you own a house, say, in an area that's really not the greatest place to be, and all you're getting is $600 a month rent, you got to pay $20, $120, and another $100. And who knows how many times they may want to come back. Now, do you think some investor who has a mortgage to pay also, real estate taxes, insurance, you think he can afford to pay $1,000 to the city to have his place inspected and still come out ahead for him and his family can eat so he can have a nest egg for his kids to go to college on? He can't. So that's why when you this thing is passed, rents are going to go up. There's going to be non-investment made in Kansas City anymore. And that's the crux of what this is all about. And I'll get into more about what happens at $20.
All right. This is Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. We're discussing question one on the August 7th ballot with Henry Lyons and Mike Duffy. I think I want to talk more about what this is going to look like for the future. Mike, you mentioned that it might lead to reduced strain on other city services, which could be cost-saving for the city. But
like fire prevention.
Right. But Henry, you also mentioned that you sort of see this as, you could say, like anti-growth, or it's going to discourage investment. So if you guys want to just sort of talk about those and then some other things that you envision, how this might look. If it gets implemented.
Yeah, Jake, let me address Henry's point about investment, particularly in the inner city. It's no surprise or secret to anybody that we have a huge amount of disinvestment in the inner city already. I mean, this ordinance isn't going to cause it. It's already there. It's a phenomenon, as Henry acknowledged, it's been longstanding. We have vacant apartment buildings all over the inner city, and that's because they've been disinvested in. We've had investors who have come in. Over 80% of the residents in the central city, in the minority community, rent. They don't own. And they rent basically from landlords who don't live in the community. They live in Johnson County. They live far east. They live, in many cases, now out of state. We have large investors buying vast pieces of rental property and not maintaining them. They're milking these properties until they finally get so bad that they have to be abandoned. And we can see the evidence of that. We see the vacant properties. The goal of this ordinance is to try to catch these maintenance problems before they get to the point where housing has to be lost. We want to require these properties to be maintained in a safe and habitable condition so that they're good not only for the tenants today, but for future generations of the community. So to say that this ordinance is going to hurt the community, no, it's going to help the community. And prominent leaders in the African-American community have already endorsed this. Reverend Hartsfeld, Diane Charity, head of a neighborhood association. The people who have come out against it in the minority community are by and large property owners and investors and landlords. And I know that they don't like paying. Who wouldn't? I'm a businessman. It's an extra cost and burden. But it's the kind of thing that we need as a community to make our community healthy and safe.
I'm very insulted as an African-American that he would call the leaders of Freedom Incorporated real estate tycoons and people who have a lot of money. These people made Kansas City what it is today, and you're disparaging them. Mike, you know better than that. You know, it's Reverends in Freedom Incorporated. It's everyday working people who go to the polls every election and hand out things to tell you what Freedom Incorporated feels you should vote for and what you shouldn't vote for. These are not rich people living in Mission Hills or someplace like that. So that's everybody knows that that's just not true.
All right. Well, let's try to get back to the.
I'm not quite through. And if there are a lot of vacant buildings in the inner city, you know why? Because the money it takes to put them together to rent them out is so great, and the loans and stuff are so onerous with the interest, you can't charge enough rent to get your money back. So that's why there's vacant buildings in inner city and vacant houses, because there's no way you can invest that kind of money to build that place back up and make a profit. So now when you add this $20 and $100, $150 onto it, that's even more disincentive to invest, because now you got even a larger burden. So this is not going to help. And there again, I said it, the Prospect Business Association is developing Prospect Avenue from 75th all the way down to 9th. This ordinance will be hell on them trying to build that community back. Because there again, who's going to come in, invest in something that has these kind of onerous fees and fines and stuff on it like this? They are against this ordinance, and they're not rich people. They are small shops, small businesses, a group of businesses, and the leaders who put a, Don Maxwell put a brand new store on Linwood and Prospect. It hasn't been there in years. He's not for this ordinance. And he's not some rich person living in Mission Hills. They know this will disinvest further the inner city of blacks and poors, and they won't be able to do it. And the thing, everything you want to do is done right here already, can be done by the laws that exist on the books right now.
All right, Mike, we'll give you, we've got only 30 seconds left, but if you want to quickly respond to some of what Henry said there.
Well, Henry's last point about we already have enough in place. As I mentioned, the city codes inspector who ran the department for years said, no, we don't have enough. We can't go in without consent. This ordinance gives the opportunity of inspectors to go in on a random basis and make sure that these are safe and healthy places. As I said earlier, like in restaurants, why wait till somebody gets poisoned before we have an inspector go in and try to prevent the problem to begin with? So, no, this is going to help citizens all across the city. This is not just about the inner city. 30% of all tenants have serious problems, and that means all across the city, the Northland, the south part of Kansas City. Every tenant in the city can benefit from this.
I disagree, and like I said, you want people coming into your house late at night when you're not there or inspecting your unit, and it's not going to work.
Mike, Henry, we really appreciate your guys' opinions. Really valuable conversation today, so thank you both for coming into the studio and talking with us live. This is Jacob White, and this has been Heartland Labor Forum.
Kansas City's number one award-winning, longest-running radio comedy theater program, Shots of the Night, is coming to the KC Fringe. We're a little right of OMG, a little left of WTF, but dead center of LOL. There's five performances of Shots of the Night Comedy Theater at the KC Fringe Festival, opening night Saturday, July 21st at 5 p.m. at Musical Heritage Theater. Additional details and show times at kcfringe.org. All proceeds support 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI is a non-commercial radio station. That means we receive financial support from our community marketing partners. These partners share information about their organization or event while supporting KKFI's mission. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Missourians know how to spot a good idea, and Right to Work is one of them. Right to Work means more freedom and more choices for Missouri workers. Right to Work also means more jobs and makes our state a better place to work and raise a family. 25 other states already embrace this good idea and are experiencing more growth in their states. So tell your legislator, Right to Work is right for Missouri.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. That was an ad from Americans for Prosperity trying to convince people to vote yes on Proposition A on the August ballot that would confirm the legislature's passage last year of a right-to-work law for Missouri. Americans for Prosperity is a creation of the right-wing Koch brothers and is heavily funded by them. Their anti-union views are well known. Just last week, thousands of Missourians received a postcard in the mail that appeared to be from a union member endorsing Right to Work. In fact, it was from Americans for Prosperity. It said, "Right to Work ensures that my union keeps working hard to support me." The argument is that if workers who are represented by a union don't have to pay dues to support the work of the union, that the leaders the union members elect will have to stop presumably sitting on their asses all day and start working hard to represent the workers who don't pay for the services they get by law. Something like that anyway. Meanwhile, of course, Missouri unions are fighting fiercely for a no vote on Proposition A. In April, on the Heartland Labor Forum, in preparation for the Right to Work fight and the vote on August 7th, we interviewed Bill Fletcher, Jr., a longtime labor activist and educator, in order to get some history and context of Right to Work. We're replaying that interview that I did in April.
Bill Fletcher, Jr. is one of the few well-known people today in the labor movement who is both an intellectual and a practitioner. He's held top staff positions in the AFL-CIO and other unions, and his books have served to stimulate thought among novices and hardened activists both. When he speaks, he always gives you something to make you uncomfortable in your certainties and to leave you mulling over new ideas. If you haven't read their Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions or Solidarity Divided, then treat yourself to a feast of ideas. So, as Missouri enters a summer of intense polarization over so-called right to work, which labor is simply calling Proposition A with a big fat no in front of it, I thought it's time to get some wisdom about how to fight the right-wing agenda from Bill Fletcher. And he was kind enough to give us some time. Welcome to the show, Bill. Let's start with your definition of right to work. What is it?
Right to work is a very brilliant PR stunt that was put together by ultra-conservatives in the 1940s as a way of convincing the public that being in a union was somehow contrary to democracy and free choice, freedom of choice. It was also something that, and this is something that a lot of people aren't aware of, was crafted in the South and the Southwest explicitly on racial terms. In other words, the architects of Right to Work, particularly a guy named Vance Muse, had an explicit racial message to white workers that they should support Right to Work because otherwise they will find themselves in unions with black people and have to call black people brothers and sisters. Now, as extreme as that may sound, that's actually, it's documented. So that's the roots of this, and Right to Work has nothing to do with freedom of choice. It really is actually appealing to greed.
And it also is, as you've just illustrated, extremely divisive within the workforce itself, right?
Completely, because basically what it's doing is it's saying that unions should be the only institution in the country that have a statutory obligation to represent people and not receive any compensation to cover the cost of that representation. An example, the analogy that I always give is this. I want your listeners to stop and think of any town, village, city, or state in the United States where taxation is voluntary and where, at the same time, you get free police, fire, water, sewer, and education. It doesn't exist. Everyone knows just such a thing doesn't exist. But what happens in Right to Work is that you will have a situation where an individual worker can choose not to pay to help to cover the cost of representation, yet the union is obligated to represent them, which means that they have to use the money of the honest dues payers. It's completely absurd.
Until 2010, we actually contained pretty much the Right to Work states. Yes, Oklahoma passed Right to Work in the early 2000s, but it wasn't gaining traction in states across the Mason-Dixon line, so to speak. But now, since 2010, we've seen Michigan, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Indiana, Kentucky, all go Right to Work, and now Missouri is threatening to. So what's changed, and why is it back in such force?
There's a few reasons, Judy. One is, and probably the most important, is that as the trade union movement has weakened, this has opened up a means for the Right to Work forces to come forward. And so as opposed to in years past when you'd have states like Michigan that were very heavily unionized, as the unionization rate in these states weakened, so too did the pro-union sentiment in those states. So that's one thing. The second thing is that we're also reaping the results of a very long-term ideological offensive by the right wing. And I point to the era of Reagan as a critical point because it was during that era that the notion that people should only pay for what they need and what they get became a very prominent slogan of the right. It became a way that the right wing argued against taxation. They would say, for example, you shouldn't pay for public education if you don't have kids in public school. It's that sort of appeal to selfishness. Well, that ended up not just staying in the sphere of taxation, but it started spreading into other things. It's just this appeal to selfishness, this idea that we should not care about our sisters and brothers, we should only care about ourselves, which obviously comes back and bites us in the rear when we actually need help from others. But it became very persuasive. So that grew over time as part of the growth of the right, because 2010 was the year of the dramatic midterm elections when the Tea Party forces accelerated their push for power.
So what do you think are their major objectives today? For instance, say Missouri goes right to work and we lose this referendum that's going to take place either in August or November. We still don't know. What are they going to gain by making Missouri another right to work state?
Well, the objective is the annihilation of unions. And they're very clear about that. The objective is the annihilation of unions. And what they gain from the annihilation of unions is the weakening of any force among workers that can fight for and push for justice. So the idea would be that when you weaken the unions, when the unions have fewer resources to do organizing, representation, political action, whatever, then the corporate America can just simply stomp on workers and walk straight through. That's what their aim is, and it's amazing. Now they hide it with a lot of fancy rhetoric.
Right.
They'll talk about freedom of choice, that somehow right to work would enhance a worker's freedom of speech. Well, that's bogus. There's nothing about being in a union that restricts your freedom of speech. You can be in a situation, as you well know, where a union takes a certain position on a political candidate, on an issue, and as a union member, you're not obligated to support that view. But it is the view of the majority, and as it should be. So there is no restrictions on freedom of speech. That is basically just a red herring in order to convince people that right to work is part of truth, justice, and the American way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're seeing in the attacks on voting rights and the threats to democracy that, in fact, the right wing actually doesn't believe in democracy, doesn't believe in majority rules. So is this just another example of that, do you think?
Yeah, I think that it is. That this is a further attempt to consolidate the hold that the wealthy have over this country. You see, one of the things that they recognize and that we don't actually talk enough about is that unions represent a major feature of democracy, because what unions do, among other things, is that they block the unbridled control that employers have over the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
The workplace in a non-union setting is fundamentally totalitarian, and it's something that very few people talk about. When you're in a non-union workplace, you essentially, once you enter through the doors, you are giving up a whole set of rights. When you're in a non-union workplace, you have no freedom of speech. You have no freedom of the press. You have no freedom of association. You are under the thumb of the owner. And people frequently don't think about that, because when you think about it in those terms, you might decide that you need to do something about it. But that's the setting that corporate America wants to impress upon us all.
Mm-hmm.
So right to work becomes a mechanism to do that. And it plays, I mentioned before about playing to greed. And this is the thing that we have to really understand. That what right to work is saying to individual workers is that you can take the risk of not paying dues or not paying an agency fee because somebody else will pay. And therefore, even though you're not paying anything, you're going to be guaranteed representation. But that's a very, very dicey risk. Because if in effect everybody says that, then the union collapses. because the union will not have the resources in order to be able to conduct organizing and representation.
Right.
People that are pushing right to work know that.
Right. Yeah. And currently, of course, we're seeing a pushing of right to work in the public sector, too, with the Janus case, which
that's
is
right.
in the Supreme Court. But that's a whole other topic. I want to talk about Missouri. So labor did an enormously powerful job of collecting signatures on an initiative petition to repeal the right to work law that was passed in the 2016 legislative session.
You're listening to an interview about right to work that was done in April with Bill Fletcher, Jr. I'm Judy Ansel, and I asked Bill what he thought it would take for labor to defeat right to work in Missouri.
Well, you know, Missouri had a right to work campaign back in, 1978, if I'm not
right,
mistaken.
Right, that's correct, yes.
And that effort at right to work was defeated.
Uh-huh.
And it was the effort to defeat it was led by Jerry Tucker, then a prominent leader in the United Auto Workers. And one of the things about any successful effort to defeat right to work is that you have to make the argument at the level of economic justice. You can't make the argument at the level of we've got to protect these institutions that are called unions. Partly because most workers are not in union, but second and more importantly, the aim of right to work is to weaken efforts at economic justice. Now that means that whether someone is in a union or not in a union, they have an interest in economic justice. I mean, once upon a time when you had a significant percentage of the workforce that was unionized, people that were not unionized would often benefit because their employers would understand that if they didn't treat their workforce better, there was a very good chance that there would be unionization. And there were patterns that were set that helped to raise the living standard of workers all over this country. As unions have weakened, that whole notion has gone out the window, and our living standard has declined. There's a direct correlation between the decline of unions and, as a percentage, and the decline in the living standard of the average U.S. worker. The right-to-work forces want that to continue. That argument needs to be made to the broader public. So people have to understand what really is at stake there. And that means a broad campaign. It means reaching and developing allies that are outside of the workplace, you know, community-based groups, religious institutions, et cetera. And there'll be different reasons that people will tend to gravitate towards a campaign to defeat right to work. Many religious institutions will immediately get the moral aspect of this mm-hmm. and understand the immorality behind those that are pushing right to work. There will be community-based groups that will understand the impact of a further decline in the living standard. And so the unions need to be reaching out very broadly in this and to turn the effort to defeat right to work into an effort to promote economic justice. And one final thing about that is that we then have to become proactive. And becoming proactive, among other things, seems to me to involve creating a situation where workers actually have rights at work. And what that means, by way of example, is that we should have, all workers should have a guarantee of just cause before they're terminated. You know, right now, if you don't have a union or if you don't have a personalized contract, you can be terminated by an employer for any reason or no reason as long as it doesn't violate a statute like race, gender, religion. But other than that, an employer can get rid of you. So why isn't the union movement pushing so that in every state constitution, workers have basic rights at work, including just cause provisions before terminations? We've got to go on the offensive. And this defeating right to work can be part of that counteroffensive.
We've had discussions about that in Missouri Jobs with Justice, talking about sponsoring an initiative like that for Just Cause and ending at-will employment in Missouri. I think it's a great idea. This year, we're trying to go on the offensive by increasing the minimum wage in Missouri, which will be on the ballot as well in November.
Good.
But thank you. Yeah, thank you for that advice. We have like 1 minute left, and I really wanted to ask you, what do you think labor gets wrong about white men? Because there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the Trump voter, and there's been a lot of discussion about union members who voted for Trump. Just in a nutshell, what aren't they thinking about that they need to?
The leadership of organized labor thinks that if you talk with white workers, white men in particular, about what's going on, about issues of race, about the right wing, that you're going to scare them off, that they're going to run away screaming, having completely lost their minds. And I think that that's absurd. I think that if you actually link a discussion with history and you talk with white men about what's actually going on, we'll be able to win over millions. But you have to step away from cowardice.
Okay. Thank you. That was in a nutshell. We've been talking to Bill Fletcher, and I want to thank you very much, Bill, for being on the show. I think that you give us a lot of wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel again, and it's Washington Window on Workers, if you couldn't tell by the music. And with us on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Judy. You're having me follow Bill Fletcher? That's a tough act.
That's a tough act to follow, right? Well, I know you're going to do your best. So I want to congratulate you because your weekly news service finally had a story from Kansas City, and you covered the Brent Welder rally last week with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What made you do that?
Because Brent Welder, first of all, he's a Teamster. That's the first thing. The second thing is that he's in the line of the progressives, just like Alexandria and Bernie are, and he's got their backing, but he also has union backing as well. I mean, the list of unions that ranged all the way from the Boilermakers, who are headquartered there in Kansas City, to the Teamsters, his own union, to Local 10 of IBEW, to you name it. So he's got a lot of them in his corner, and he's got the progressives rather than in some other races where I've seen the two on opposite sides of the ledger.
That's
good for him.
It probably wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that this is a district that is considered, where the incumbent Republican is considered quite vulnerable, would it?
Yes, it would, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
I mean, if the incumbent Republican had to fly tents in, what was it, last week, for a $4,500 per picture fundraiser with him, because the incumbent Republican, even though he has about $2 million in the bank, won by only one percentage point. And that was in a district that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016.
I would also say that in that district where I happen to live, there are a large number of immigrants. And just yesterday, Kevin Yoder, the congressman, actually broke with Trump on part of the issue on immigration, which I think surprised a lot of people. But if you understand what's going on politically in the district, it's not so surprising. So I want to talk about another story you did this week, and that is your story about Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Kavanaugh, and the response of labor. And last week on the show, Angie Williams talked about Kavanaugh's legal record as far as labor is concerned. And so I wonder if you could focus a little bit about what labor is trying to do to defeat the Kavanaugh nomination.
Well, right now there's mobilizing going on. It hasn't really surfaced yet because things have just gotten started. But the mobilizing is focusing on swing senators, the two Republican female senators who are pro-choice and Kavanaugh is not, and the four Democrats who might go the other way, including Claire McCaskill, because those are the states that Trump carried by double-digit margins. So the mobilizing is going on in those states,
mm-hmm.
although now the labor movement is probably going to help see what they can do, get their field operations going, and bring in people from all over the country to target those particular senators, or rather to have their constituents target the particular senators is the best way of putting it.
Okay, so it's going to be a ground game on the most vulnerable people.
Right.
Okay.
There's already an air war going from the other side.
Right.
I was in Chicago last week, and I was seeing pro-Kavanaugh commercials, which are going to go nowhere because Illinois has two very, very progressive senators in a blue state. There's no way that Tammy Duckworth and Dick Durbin are going to vote for Kavanaugh.
Right.
It seems to be a waste of money.
Yeah. Well, that's actually going to be it's going to be very interesting to watch this play out. And finally,
right. You
had a story which is kind of unprecedented, where the American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, came out condemning the state of Israel, the nation of Israel, for its recent moves to turn itself into a basically apartheid state. And I mention that because things are changing. The politics are changing. Just for the first time last week in Kansas City, a chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace was formed. We don't have the Jewish Labor Committee here, but that is unprecedented here in Kansas City. So we're starting to see more and more Jews break with the state of Israel. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Well, the Jewish Labor Committee and Randy Weingarten both condemned this apartheid-type law that Netanyahu pushed through the Israeli parliament, the one that would degrade Arabic as one of the official languages. It would do a whole bunch of other things to make the Israeli Arabs, who are one-fifth of the population, second-class or even third-class citizens, and it would sort of enshrine the right wing as a matter of and the right wing views in Israel. As a matter of fact, one thing that Randy Weingarten said was she linked it straight to Trump because Trump and Netanyahu are as thick as thieves, in so many words.
Uh-huh.
So she made the linkage. She said, you take your pick about who's picking up what from who, in so many words. But this is something that Netanyahu's policies have upset much of the American labor movement for a while. They've upset certainly a lot of the American Jewish community, with the exception of the Orthodox, for even longer. Now it's coming out into the open. There's a point beyond which you say, so much and no more. You have to be public in your opposition to a right-wing government like that.
Well, this is going to cause some problems for some Democrats, I'm afraid, if the labor community is breaking with them. And we'll stay tuned on that question. So I think we're out of time, Mark. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next month. And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Kansas City Union Veterans Council on their Day of Action, and that's going to be Saturday. This is Kansas City Union Veterans Council is having a day of action on Proposition A. That's Saturday, July 28th at 9 a.m. at the Pipefitters Hall, Pipefitters Local 533 at 8600 Hillcrest in Kansas City, Missouri. So Union Veterans, show up. A. Philip Randolph Institute, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, the Heavy Laborers, and the Walnut Grove Neighborhood Association are having a community health and awareness fair, July 28th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and that's going to be at 7820 Prospect, Kansas City, Missouri. I'm sure they'll be doing blood pressure and health care counseling and diabetes counseling and all of the things you can get when there's a free health care. So show up to that, too. Kansas City Area Labor Picnic is going to be at Longview Lake Beach, 11101 Raytown Road, August 4th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's a week from this Saturday, and all labor is invited. Bring your own food. Film showing, The Surveilling of Black Lives Matter, August 4th, 2 to 5 p.m., All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. That's all we have time for. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. And tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We are going to be looking at an issue. I can't remember now. Check our calendar and check our webpage. Thanks to tonight's engineers. And